On slide number one, today's 2-hour session is designed to help you better understand the proposal criteria and the selection process for EPA's brownfields assessment, cleanup, and revolving loan fund grants. Earlier this year, we did a more general session to introduce brownfields and the concepts and some of the funding that's available, and this is a more technical workshop for folks who are actually applying for grants. Moving to slide number two, again, I'm Ted Lanzano, and I'm a Brownfields Project Manager here in Region 8, and also with us is Dan Heffernan. He's our Brownfields Coordinator. And slide number three. So we have a really full agenda, and I'm going to begin by providing a general overview of Brownfields and the types and amounts of funds and the grants that are available. Might be a review for some of you. And then I'll pass it over to Dan, who will have a more technical discussion of the competitive grant process. And he'll go over the threshold criteria and the ranking criteria. And then I'll finish it off with some useful application tips, some additional resources, and then we'll have the QA session. That's just a little bit of how the 2 hours is going to proceed here. So moving to slide number four, it might look like we made a mistake on this one, but we really didn't. And this slide shows that one of the key aspects of our program is to not only clean up a site, but also turn it into productive use. What we try to avoid in our program is that we start with a dirt field and a chain link fence, and then after the cleanup, we end up with a dirt field and a chain link fence. And even though the site might be clean, well, the community doesn't offer a lot of benefits in that process. So we want to not only clean up a site, but turn it into something productive for the community, and that way your before and afters don't look the same. Moving to slide five. So to that end, our program is designed to help communities get through hurdles and work together to assess, clean, and reuse brownfields properties. We understand that contamination issues can be difficult challenges, and that's why our resources and technical assistance are here to help you overcome those challenges. Moving to slide number six, you may have seen this definition. Many people have their own definition of what a brownfield is, but EPA, we have our own as well, and it is real property, the expansion, redevelopment, or reuse of which may be complicated by the presence or presence of hazardous substance, pollutants, and contaminants. So what does that mean? Well, basically, for you to get EPA funding for your project, it needs to meet this definition, and there needs to be some sort of contamination, either perceived contamination or actual contamination. It needs to be real property, your site does, and there also needs to be a reuse potential there. So those are some of the key components of our of the brownfields definition. And moving to slide seven, what counts as contamination? Well, after the Brownfields Law of 2002, we now have a very broad definition that encompasses many different contaminants. It's not just limited to an EPA list of hazardous substances. It can come from contamination associated with old gas stations, scrap yards, mine-scarred lands, asbestos, lead paint, just to name a few, and we really try to be as open as possible with this. So the definition of what a contaminant is really broad, and chances are the contamination that you have there will meet our definition of what a contamination is. So moving to slide eight, you know, by having an interest in this call and possibly considering applying for grant, you probably already know of what some of the benefits of brownfield revitalization are. But just to review a few here, you know, they really have a significant impact on communities. And some of the way they do that is by increasing local tax base, facilitating new job growth, utilizing existing infrastructure, and preventing sprawl. There's a statistic here that we use that for every acre of contaminated property that's redeveloped, 4.5 acres of green space are preserved. The idea being that not only are we reusing a site, but we're also preventing the need for additional roads and infrastructure that go out to the development of that greenfield. So, moving to slide number 9, on a national level, the impact of the Brownfields program has really been pretty tremendous. And for a $595 million investment since 1995, we've assessed almost 12,000 properties, leveraged $11 billion in brownfields cleanup and redevelopment funding, and generated almost 50,000 jobs. So, again, the impact by communities with our grants has really been pretty impressive. So, moving to slide number 10, I'm going to talk now about some of the different grant opportunities that we have, and the picture here on the slide is from Peanut Mine in Crested Butte, Colorado. And here they were able to clean up a site, an old mine-scarred land, and really turn it into end uses for preservation and recreation. And we often talk about the economic benefits of redeveloping brownfield sites, but we also, another reuse that we encourage is simply for environmental preservation. And that was the goal of the community in this project. So moving to slide 11, here is a quick look at the overall budget on a national level for brownfields, and approximately $70 to $75 million every year goes towards assessment grants, revolving loan fund grants, and cleanup grants. And then we also have $50 million that Congress set aside to fund a portion of state and tribal brownfields core programs. And I think this year, actually, for the top three grants, they're the assessment, revolving loan fund, and cleanup, we have $80 million this year. So it's gone up a little bit. On slide 12, so of all those programs, grants that I mentioned in that previous slide, today we're just going to be talking about the assessment, revolving loan fund, and cleanup. And we have many names for these. We call them ARC. For the acronym, we call them 104K grants, and we call them our competitive brownfields grants. So seems like people around here and in the brownfields community use these terms interchangeably. So just so you're aware of the multiple names here, we no longer use the word pilot, so that has been phased out. On slide 13, and you should know that EPA grants are competitive. And it really does take time to constructing an award-winning proposal, so we hope you'll take that time. And on slide 14, we talk about how, just so you have an idea of how competitive they are. And EPA received 845 proposals last year, or for FY08, and we funded 314 of these. So roughly a third are being funded. And however, Region 8 is somewhat underrepresented in this nationally. And while it is competitive, we have an advantage here because we don't get as many grant proposals. And there are national efforts to have greater distribution of grants across all regions. And there's also efforts to have fair distribution of grants between rural and urban communities. So all of that can certainly be a benefit to Region 8. Okay, and slide 15. this is a little bit on the application timeline. And we now have official dates to this slide. So this slide here is a bit dated. And the ARC request for proposals, again, that's assessment, revolving loan fund, and cleanup. The request for proposals was released on August 22nd, and proposals are due on November 14th. Typically, we have given applicants 60 days to apply, but since we've made so many changes to our guidelines this year that Dan's going to be talking about, we thought it would be fair to allow folks some extra time to develop your proposals. And then next spring, we'll be awarding roughly $80 million to get folks started with their projects. So moving to slide 16, this talks about where you can find the request for proposals and the guidelines. And you have two options. And it's just the main EPA Brownfields website there, and also at grants.gov. So encourage you to check those out, and if you haven't already. On slide 17, I'm going to start talking about just the three grant programs that we'll be discussing in more detail today, the first one being the assessment grant program. And the purpose of these is really broad, and they can be used to inventory brownfield sites, characterize sites, conduct a phase one or a phase two environmental assessment, community involvement, and they're really pretty broad as far as what you can do with these. And this is the one of the three where there is actually not a match requirement, so pretty good deal. And assessment grants can be used for community-wide, site-specific, and also for assessment coalitions. And by community-wide, that means basically you can use this grant to assess a number of different sites across your across the area which you're applying for. And new for this year is that with community-wide assessments, you can submit one proposal that addresses both hazardous substance and petroleum for a total of up to $400,000. Last year, you had to submit a separate proposal, and many communities were, you know, submitting the same proposal. So we figured it would be better to save some, reduce some redundancies there, and allow for just one proposal for both hazardous substance and petroleum. On slide 18, if you're not interested in community-wide and you just have one site and you want to assess, you certainly can do a site-specific proposal, and up to $200,000 for petroleum or hazardous substances, and you can get up to a $350,000 per property with a waiver. And let's see, site-specific assessments are not as common, but certainly something that that works with the program. On slide 19. Another new for this year, you may have heard that there is up to $1 million for assessment coalitions. Basically, three or more eligible entities can form a coalition and apply for assessments. And you must assess a minimum of five sites coalition-wide. It doesn't mean that each coalition member has to assess five sites. Rather, for the $1 million, you have to assess a minimum of five sites. So we're excited about that, and we certainly hope to receive some applications for assessment coalitions this year. Okay, moving to slide 20. This is just a quick success story of an assessment grant. And in Ouray County, Colorado, in southern Colorado, they assessed over 231 mining claims over almost over 2,000 acres, and it resulted in the transfer of about 130 acres over to public ownership. So this is definitely a story that we're proud of, and we hope we see more projects like this in the future. On slide 21, talks about the Revolving Loan Fund. And basically what this is this is a grant that we give out up to $1 million per eligible entity that goes to communities so that they can make low interest or no interest loans to borrowers, typically private developers, but doesn't necessarily have to be. So in essence, the grantee in this case is acting almost like a banker, where they're providing financing for cleanup projects. And coalitions can certainly apply to this, and there is a cost share requirement of 20%. And then nonprofit organizations are not eligible to apply on this one. So the next slide talks about just a quick success story here in the city of Aurora by Denver, Colorado, and they used their RLF grant to finance the cleanup of an old dump in the city, and which is now a park and also a clean lot that's slated for affordable housing. On slide 23 is our cleanup grants, and these are used to carry out cleanup activities at brownfield sites, up to $200,000 per property, and it can address hazardous substance or petroleum contamination. And you can apply for up to 3 properties, but you do need to have separate proposals for each one of those. And nonprofits can apply. There's a cost share requirement. And what I don't see here on this slide is that you need to have a phase 2 assessment complete by the time you apply. And the reason for that is EPA just wants to be sure by the time we award the grant that you are ready to go with your cleanup and that you don't still have to do any characterization or assessments there and that you can just get started with the cleanup. Another thing is that while you can apply without actually owning the site, by the time the award or by the time June 30th next year, you actually do need to own the site. So something to think about if you are considering applying for this. And here's a success story of a cleanup grant in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where they were able to clean up a large site there and basically connect the downtown corridor to, I believe it's to the riverfront there. And it's a pretty impressive project that leveraged millions and millions of dollars in this project. So moving to slide 25, we also have there are other EPA financial assistance is available. This is not what we primarily are talking about today, but we have our Brownfields Job Training Grant Program, and this is a grant that goes typically towards universities, community college, and nonprofits to provide environmental skills for people in areas that are affected by brownfields so that then they can go work in the environmental field and address those sites that are in their community. Just so you know, the request for proposals is out now, and the proposals, I believe, are due on October 15th. And then we also have what we call targeted brownfield assessments, which is not a grant. Rather, it's direct assistance by EPA, by our consultants, to do environmental assessments for you. And this can be a phase 1 or a phase 2. And pretty quick turnaround, and the application there is just on our website if you're interested in that. So. With that, I'm going to pass it over to Dan to start talking about some of the threshold requirements, and then I'll take it back in a little bit.
Thanks, Ted. I'm going to assume, by not hearing anything from anyone, that you're not having technical difficulties and people are able to advance the slides. Give a holler if you are having any problems with that. We do have a technician on the line who can try and troubleshoot if you are having problems. My name is Dan Heffernan. I work with Ted Lanzano and a group of folks here in Denver. And I want to thank Ted for that introduction to brownfields that he just gave. First and foremost, for folks in EPA Region 8, we are here to help out. If you've got questions, if you've got concerns, if you think you've got an elementary question, there's nothing too elementary, please give us a call. Our contact information is throughout here, and it will be at the end as well. For folks outside of EPA Region 8, if you don't know who to contact, if you're not in our 6 state, 27 tribe region, go ahead and give us a call or an email, and we'll put you in contact with the right people in your part of the country, because there are 10 offices of EPA, and they will be more than happy to help you out. Please do send us questions as we go along here. Along the top of your presentation, I believe it'll be on the top of the presentation, there should be a submit questions button. If you send those in, we'll start working on those, and as we get towards the end of the presentation, we will we'll go through those and answer them one by one as time allows before we run out of time here. So please do be sending those in, and then we will open it up for verbal questions as well at the end. Okay, starting out then on slide number 27. 26 there is just an example of a cleanup project. It's a little bit of eye candy in Miles City, Montana, real neat project that we had there. But moving on to slide number 27, we're going to talk first about the threshold criteria for the grant types that we're going to be discussing today that Ted went through. These threshold criteria are primarily legal criteria set up in the Brownfields Law of 2002. Therefore, we don't have much discretion over these at EPA. However, a few of them are also policy decisions, and those are primarily aimed at ensuring that you have you are prepared to have a successful project on the ground when we fund you with this grant program. So first we have these threshold criteria, which we'll go through, and then we'll go through the ranking criteria, which are actually numeric scoring, how we decide at EPA which projects to fund, because there is a lot more demand than there is money, unfortunately. The important thing to note here is that the threshold questions in the guidelines are a pass-fail basis. If you fail any one of the threshold criteria, you will not be ranked. Your proposal will not be ranked for funding and will be dismissed at that point. We will try to clarify anything that allows clarification, but if it's something you apply for a grant and you're a private individual, you're not a government or a nonprofit, you're an ineligible applicant, your proposal will not be ranked. So these are pass-fail, and you've got to pass them all, so please do answer each one of these thoroughly. Slide number 28. This lists the various threshold criteria. We're going to go through them one by one. Note that not all criteria apply to assessment, revolving loan fund, and cleanup applicants. What we've done is we've put in parens after each or at the top of each of the next few slides. We put in parens which type of grant it applies to. Some of these criteria do apply to all three grant types. Some are specific to just revolving loan funds, for example. So sorry if that's confusing, but what we're trying to do here is cover each of the three grant types all in one presentation. So please go ahead and let us know if you have questions on that as we go. The next slide, number 29, applicant eligibility. This is across the board for all the grant types. You've got to describe how you're an eligible applicant, and basically our eligible applicants for this grant program are governments, local governments, tribal governments, state governments, quasi-governments, regional councils of government, things like that. And so that's for the assessment, cleanup, and revolving loan funds, our governments. The one exception is for our cleanup grants, and cleanup grants only, 501c3 nonprofit organizations are also eligible on top of governments. So for assessment and revolving loan fund, only governments and quasi-governments can apply for our grants. For cleanups, nonprofits and governments and quasi-governments can apply. This is laid out in our law. Understand it's a bit cumbersome and not always what people are hoping for, but those are the applicants that are eligible for our grants. Slide number 30. This is for revolving loan fund and assessment applicants only. We do have coalition applicants that are eligible. You can apply as a coalition. We'll go through these each, but for the assessment grants, you must have three or more eligible entities that form a coalition and apply together. And for the revolving loan funds, only you need to have at least two coalition members applying. They each have to be a separate legal entity. They each have to be an eligible applicant, which is a government or quasi-government. And then you need to include in the proposal documentation of applicant eligibility, and as well as letters from each coalition member. And then you're going to have a lead coalition member who will actually be applying for the grant on behalf of the coalition, and they will be the grant recipient with EPA on behalf of the coalition. And again, you're going to need a letter from each coalition member as an attachment to your application that indicates that they will be a member of this coalition. Slide number 31. Ted already mentioned this. For cleanup grants and cleanup grants only, you must show fee simple title. You must have title to the property by June 30th of 2009 to actually receive the grant. So you can apply for this grant this fall, be selected for funding, and not take ownership until June 30th if that's advantageous for your organization. If by June 30th you have not taken ownership of the property, you will forfeit the grant, and the next highest ranking proposal for funding will be funded instead. So June 30th is the cutoff for taking ownership if you've got a real estate office or something in your building that needs to know that. Slide number 32. You need to provide a current letter from your state or tribal environmental authority that acknowledges that you're planning to apply for this grant application. If you are the tribal environmental office, you do not need to provide a letter from yourself to yourself. But if you are any other type of applicant, you need to contact the state within which you plan to work and get a letter of acknowledgement that you will attach as an attachment to your application that acknowledges that they know that you plan to apply for this grant. You're going to want to contact your state as early as possible, yesterday preferably, today if necessary, tomorrow, you know, as a last resort. You want to contact them as early as possible. Let them know that you're doing this project because, as we're going to discuss in a minute, if there needs to be a petroleum determination on the site, the state's the one that's going to require information and make the determination for petroleum. So the state plays a critical role throughout the brownfields program. They need to be on board as soon as possible with your project. If you're applying for multiple grant types, if you're a city that's applying for a revolving loan fund and assessment and a cleanup, you only need one letter from the state acknowledging all three. You don't need three different letters, but you will need to affix the letter to each of your three application packages, if that's what you're applying for. And again, provide them sufficient time to get back in touch with you and to provide you with the acknowledgement letter, and if they need to review the site, to review the site. Slide number 33. The next several sites are going to refer to site-specific applications only for assessment and cleanup applications that are for a specific site that you'd like to address. And they're going to address what is called CERCLA liability, which is Superfund liability. And I'm not going to get into too much detail here because this gets rather complicated and we'd be on the phone for a long time. But the basics of this are that the Brownfield Law prohibits EPA from providing grant funding to an entity to address a site for which they are liable for the contamination. And what's important here is that CERCLA liability is very, very broad, and it does not just apply to those who caused or contributed to the contamination. It has a whole number of provisions for transporters and management and all kinds of things of sites. So you need to know, if you are planning on applying for a specific site, you need to know if you, as the applicant, are potentially liable under the Superfund law. That probably means talking with your attorneys, contacting EPA, trying to do some due diligence before you go too far down the road and spend too much time on something that you're not eligible to even apply for. Liability is site-specific, and it's time-specific. So because, as we're going to discuss here in a minute, there are some liability provisions that allow people to get excluded from liability. So know when you acquired the property and how you acquired the property. We'll advance on to slide number 34. There are some sites that are completely, some properties that are completely excluded from brownfields by law, from brownfields funding. Those include sites on the national priority list, which are Superfund sites generally. That's how they're generally referred to. Property subject to unilateral administrative orders, court orders, administrative orders on consent, judicial consent decrees. These are sites where there's been an order to, a federal order to take some type of action by a party on a site. The third are property subject to the jurisdiction, custody, or control of the U.S. government, Forest Service land, BLM land, etc. Federal properties are not allowable under our grant program. Slide number 35. So for site-specific assessment and cleanup applicants only, you need to determine, well, this slide goes through who's the decision maker on the threshold criteria. For hazardous sites, and contaminated sites other than petroleum, EPA is going to make a determination of that site's eligibility. And again, you cannot be potentially liable under CERCLA. There's a spelling error on CERCLA there, under the Superfund law. And we're going to get into that in just one second. The second one here, and this is harping back to getting in contact with your state officials early and often, and we're going to go through who those people are for the Region 8 states at the end of the presentation. For petroleum sites, the state is the decider as to whether or not the site is eligible for brownfield funding. You need a letter, an eligibility determination made by the state in the form of a letter. They're going to need to have specific information about the site, and they're going to make their determination based on some factors here that we'll go over in a couple of slides. You're then going to need to affix that letter from the state for petroleum sites that determines that, yes, it is an eligible site for brownfields funding for petroleum. Slide number 36. Ownership eligibility. We're now going to get into the CERCLA ownership liability issues here. There are basically a number of ways that you can, well, there's two primary ways that you can come into ownership, voluntarily and involuntarily. The first is fairly simple, the involuntary acquisition. These are tax foreclosure, eminent domain are the primary ways that governments come into ownership of properties involuntarily. If you involuntarily acquire a property, you're exempt from CERCLA liability for that site, and you can apply for a grant funding for it. If you voluntarily accept a property, there are three main ways that you can voluntarily accept a property and still be acceptable for a brownfields grant, be allowable for a brownfields grant: bona fide prospective purchasers, innocent landowners, and contiguous property owners. We're going to go through these on the next couple of slides. And then that last note there, if an exemption applies, then the site is eligible. The main point here is that there are ways to voluntarily acquire contaminated sites and not take any liability on for your organization, and in fact be able to get federal funds to address the contamination at the site. Slide number 37 starts off here with the involuntary acquisition. This is local governments, eminent domain, tax foreclosure, things of this nature. Your property is eligible for brownfield grant funding if you take the property involuntarily. If you voluntarily acquire, you purchase or accept the property via donation, then you need to have one of the three exemptions there at the bottom. Bona fide prospective purchaser being the underlined one, as this is the most commonly applied, and this is the one that generally is going to fit as far as an exemption from CERCLA goes. These get fairly complicated, and again, they're going to go beyond the scope of this presentation, but we will go through them briefly here. Slide number 38. This is the bona fide prospective purchaser exemption from CERCLA. And the criteria that must be met in order to meet this exemption. You cannot be responsible for the contamination. You can't be affiliated with the responsible party. There is a January 11th, 2002 criteria with regard to this, but we can forget that as far as grants go, because even if you acquired the property prior to January 11th, 2002, which is the date of the Brownfields Law, you can still get grant funding for it as long as you can meet the rest of the criteria listed here. There are other continuing obligations beyond just doing your all appropriate inquiry, which is the last bullet here. If you acquire a piece of contaminated property, you need to be taking steps to alleviate that contamination to minimize releases and to ensure that there's no threats to public health in the environment. So you can't just take ownership of a contaminated piece of property and say, I'm a bona fide prospective purchaser. You have to show what kind of due care you've taken once you take ownership. The final section there is all appropriate inquiry. This is an industry standard for basically doing a book report on a piece of property prior to taking ownership. There are environmental standards, standard practices for doing all appropriate inquiry. There are thousands of firms throughout the country that do this, can do this analysis for you. It must be done prior to acquisition of a piece of property. You must have a signed phase one report prior to acquiring a piece of property. And the phase one must be current. There is a shelf life on these of 1 year, with even just a 6 month shelf life on certain pieces, certain aspects of the phase one assessment. So when phase ones are done is quite critical as well. Slide number 39. This slide simply lists out some of the various standards that can apply depending on when a piece of property is voluntarily acquired. And this is in regard to the phase one, all appropriate inquiry assessment. So this is just to let you know that the standard has evolved over time and has been updated. It's going to be time specific. If you're going to apply a bona fide prospective purchaser exemption to liability, it's going to be time specific, and there's going to be a specific standard that was in place at that time, and that's what the threshold will be for all appropriate inquiry. Slide number 40. Slide number 40 is for cleanup grant applicants. It's going to require a phase one assessment is complete, regardless of if you're applying for an exemption to liability or not. You're going to need to have that phase one complete, and the phase two site assessment report has to be complete as well. And that's new this year. This is to ensure that applicants actually know the extent of contamination and have a good idea of what the costs are going to be to clean it up, and that they can get that work done in a timely manner. It's not going to take years and years and years of additional sampling on site prior to actually being able to affect the remedy there. So that's for cleanup applicants only. Slide number 41. For petroleum sites only, I alluded to this earlier. For non-tribal sites, the state within which the site resides will be making the determination as to whether or not it's eligible for brownfields funding. For tribes, EPA will make that determination. And states need to answer the criteria there under the third primary bullet, that the site is a relatively low risk, there's no viable responsible party, the applicant's not responsible for the contamination, and that there's no RCRA corrective actions, that's Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, corrective actions underway at the moment for this site. So the state's going to need some specific information in order to make these determinations. Again, get in contact with your state DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality, Department of Health, depending on your state, early so that they can start making this determination for you and get you a letter determining that the site is eligible for funding. Slide number 42. Legal authority and oversight structure. This is for cleanup and revolving loan fund applicants only, not for assessment applicants. The first is the cleanup oversight. Describe how you will oversee the cleanup. Indicate whether you're going to enroll in a state cleanup program, often called a voluntary cleanup, VCP, VCUP, a number of different things depending on state. Here you're going to indicate whether or not you're going to enroll in a state program or not, and if not, you're going to explain what the cleanup oversight process will look like for your cleanup. The second thing you need to do is discuss how you plan to obtain access to adjacent or neighboring properties throughout the cleanup. If there's one main road on and off your property, but there are three adjacent property owners that have auxiliary roads, and those may need to be used, how are you going to gain access to those, or how have you already gained access? The third bullet here is the legal opinion for revolving loan funds. We've always required two legal opinions be provided to EPA for revolving loan fund applicants. Now you can just provide one single legal opinion, because generally those opinions came from the same counselor. Now you can just provide one opinion that A, expresses the legal authority to access and secure sites within your jurisdiction, and B, the legal authority to manage a revolving loan fund, to capitalize loans within the jurisdiction that you're proposing to create a revolving loan fund within. Number 43, and we're almost through the threshold issues. I know this has taken a while, but these are a bit cumbersome. Number 43 is in regard to cost shares. The assessment application process does not require a cost share. The assessment grants do not require a cost share, which is great. The cleanup and revolving loan funds both require a 20% cost share. So for every $100,000 that you're applying for, you need to account for $20,000 on top of that in cost share. A couple of important things to note here under the first bullet. Don't exceed the required amount in the cost share in your application, or you'll be required to, that will be a requirement of the grant, that you match that amount of funding. So if it's a $100,000 request, put in $20,000 on top of that in cost share. Don't commit to $100,000 in cost share on top of the $100,000 grant, or you'll be required to meet that. And again here, know the difference between leveraging and matching. Don't state things as a match. There's a whole other section where we ask you to talk about leveraging funding, and that's where you're going to want to talk about everything over and above the 20% match that's required. The second bullet, no federal funds for the match. We try to be as flexible as possible with our match requirement, but federal dollars cannot be used. So if you've got transportation dollars, highway dollars, things like that, they cannot be applied to this. But with that said, it does not require a dollar-for-dollar match. It could be an in-kind labor, materials, or other services match that is applied here. The main thing here is that if you do apply something other than a cash match, the costs have to be eligible and allowable, which means they have to be costs that we could otherwise use grant funds to cover. So you can contact us if you've got questions on that. And there are, I should state here, there are also frequently asked questions that are referenced throughout the proposal guidelines that discuss most of these issues and give examples as well. Those are available online. The hardship waiver, which is the third primary bullet here on this slide, this does require some additional information be provided in the proposal as an attachment. If you believe that it is too much of a financial hardship to provide a cost share on your assessment or on your cleanup or revolving loan fund application, it requires an additional attachment that explains the financial circumstances as to why you can't provide that cost share, and then EPA will analyze that and make a determination whether or not the hardship waiver is going to be honored or not. The final bullet there is that a cost share, the cost share can be passed on to the borrower in the case of the revolving loan fund grant. So if you're going to capitalize a revolving loan fund, you can just pass that 20% cost share along to potential borrowers. So you don't have to come up with that dollar or labor in kind yourself. So slide number 44, this is kind of a revision this year. The community notification piece prior to applying for this grant now only applies to the cleanup applicants. So if you're applying for an assessment or revolving loan fund, you don't need to actually do community notification, letting the community know that you're applying for the funding. You're going to have to engage the public through public meetings and public notices throughout the process as you're selecting sites and you're selecting potential borrowers, things like that. But once you know your specific sites, basically, is when you're going to engage the public. If you are applying for a cleanup grant, you're going to need to do community notification prior to applying for the grant. That consists of these check marks here. First and foremost, you need to place an ad in the local newspaper that covers the target area. You're going to need to clearly communicate that a copy of the grant, your proposal for funding, is available for public review and where that proposal is and where they can see it and where people can comment on it. Slide number 45. You need to indicate that you're willing to accept or that you will accept comments on the draft proposal. And then you need to state the date and time of a public meeting where the proposal will be discussed. And this needs to be held prior to submitting the proposal to EPA for consideration. Again, this is for cleanup applications only. And again, I will refer you to the frequently asked questions that accompany these guidelines and are available online and are referenced throughout the guidelines to discuss community notification further. Finally there, you see applicants who are submitting cleanup applications for more than one site can have one public meeting as long as it's the same public that's going to be affected by both cleanups or all three cleanups, depending. You can have one public meeting and discuss all three at one time. Slide number 46. If you are applying for a revolving loan fund, you need to provide a description of the jurisdictional boundaries within which you will do your work. And we have, e.g., the city limits of City of ABC. So this is your state, your county, your city, your redevelopment authority district, whatever it is that you're applying to serve with your revolving loan fund, you need to describe the jurisdictional boundaries where you will not capitalize loans or revolving loan fund subgrants outside of those boundaries. Advancing to slide 47, taking a breath here, we're now done with the threshold issues discussion, and we're going to move on to the ranking criteria. And these are the numeric points that are ascribed to your application and then are what determine the projects that get selected for funding and those that don't. Advancing to slide 48, we have changed these quite a bit this year. So for folks who have applied in the past or who are familiar with our grant application package or request for proposals, these are going to look very different than the ranking criteria of previous years. This is assuming that you've passed the threshold criteria. You will now, these criteria will be evaluated. The nice thing here, and you'll see where that new call out is, we've now broken this down into four criteria that each have sub-criteria. This is meant to be very linear, and we're going to go through these one by one, but it's basically describe the community need for this project, tell us what the project will entail and what its feasibility is, talk to us about how the community will be involved as well as key partners will be involved in the project, and then tell us what those benefits are going to be. And we'll go through these one by one, but we think this is much more linear than how our ranking criteria have been in previous years, so hopefully this is helpful for folks. Advancing on to slide number 49. As I stated, each criteria is made up of several sub-criteria. Make sure you answer each one of these individually. Each sub-criteria may be the same or different per ranking criteria per grant type. So we have broken these application guidelines into three separate requests for proposals, three separate booklets. So make sure that you're applying, you've got the right guidelines in front of you when you're writing your application here. The other thing to note is that the sub-criteria for each of these different criteria, it varies across the grant type. So the revolving loan fund sub-criteria have different point values than the assessment sub-criteria do. So make sure that you're understanding where the weight is throughout your application package and making sure that you provide sufficient time to those sections that have the greatest points. Also important here is to note that each of the revolving loan fund assessment and cleanup grants, the total number of points that you can get are 100. So we're basically going on an academic scale here, up to 100 points. So advancing on to slide number 50. This is the first criteria, community need. This is where you're going to describe the health, welfare, and environmental issues within your targeted community and the financial need of the targeted community as it's affected by brownfields, as it relates to brownfields in the area. You're going to see called out here in italics on this and then on a number of the subsequent slides. Make sure that you identify where your source of information comes from, if it's census data or otherwise, if there have been public health studies done. Make sure that you're quoting where the information comes from and when it was created. Slide number 51. This is breaking into the sub-criteria a bit under health, community need, the health, welfare, and environment piece. This is where you're going to describe the brownfields in your area, the number of them, the size of the brownfields, any impacts that they have on human health, welfare, and the environment. So you can discuss here some of the typical contaminants in your area. You can discuss here sensitive populations for the area, elderly and very young, perhaps. And then you can discuss things like disproportionate environmental impacts, if you've got such data, things such as cancer studies or asthma rates, if you've got data that backs up that there are some disproportionate health impacts in your area, and you can link those back to your brownfields sites in the area. That's to your advantage. Again, identify all information sources if you're going to be quoting any studies, giving any percentages, things like that. Slide 52, the financial need part. Describe the economic impact of the brownfields on your targeted community or area and demonstrate what the economic need is for the area. Provide the rates of poverty, household income, unemployment rate, and other widely available demographic information. Use the most current data that you can get your hands on, and use the most relevant data sources as well. To the extent you can use table formats and do some kind of a comparison to perhaps statewide or nationwide or county-by-county comparisons, whatever you can use to give us some kind of perspective for the information, economic information you're providing us, that's going to be your benefit. Discuss the impacts of things like closed factories, job losses, things of that nature, and what those impacts are on the community and as well as the local government and its ability to function tax revenue-wise and such. And then provide factors explaining why the financial resources are not available for the brownfields work that you're proposing to do. So if there are specific fiscal considerations or population size of the area perhaps is very low, these are the kind of things you want to discuss, why this funding is necessary to do the work that you're proposing to do. This is moving on to the second criteria.
Under the ranking portion, project description and feasibility of success. So now you've told us about your community and why this project is important. Now, how do you propose to go about the work of it? Under this criteria, we're looking for the reasonableness of the approach to your project, that you have sufficient resources to complete the project, and that you have the capacity to complete the project in a timely manner. There are some items called out here with stars, just so that these are kind of FYIs. Projects that budget the majority of the grant funding, and this is for assessment grants, to conduct actual site assessments are going to be viewed more favorably by reviewers than grants that are primarily focused on, or proposals that are primarily focused on planning activities. For assessment coalitions, you must assess a minimum of 5 sites coalition-wide. So if you've got 3 or more communities who are going to come in for an assessment coalition, you've got to be proposing to assess at least 5 sites. Six E, brownfield programmatic requirements.
you read EPA expectations of projects funded to ground.
ESMIC grants. Okay, slide number 54. For all grant types, again, assessment cleanup revolving loan fund, you've got to describe the project that you're proposing to fund. For cleanup proposals, you also have to describe the proposed cleanup that you're proposing to do, the institutional or engineering controls that will be put in place may be necessary, and then what your site reuse plan is once cleanup is complete, what's going to happen with that site next. And then how does that relate back to the institutional or engineering controls, assuming that the site is not cleaned up to pristine condition. Remember here that you need to have already had your Phase 2 environmental assessment done. This is the sampling assessment prior to applying for this cleanup grant. So you should have a pretty decent idea of what cleanup options will be and what the reuse of the site, what the appropriate reuse of the site would be. Slide number 55, for RLF applicants only, the first bullet here is, let's skip to the second one here. The sustainability of the plan for your revolving loan fund. One of the main things with revolving loan funds is how can you need to show that the revolving loan fund will actually revolve and then will be able to be used for multiple cleanups going into the future. So you need to show how it's a sustainable plan, time-wise, the amount of loans, what the interest rate will be on those loans, et cetera.
The borrowers and sub-grantees would be?
Who's your borrower community? Under what circumstances would you allow a sub-grant to do a cleanup? And then what's your marketing plan to ensure that you have a customer base and you have projects coming in the door? That will require or will be requesting loans. Basically, the main thing here is to discuss what your plan for RLF success will be. A piece of that is discussing who your RLF team will be, who's going to be dedicated to managing this. RLFs are fairly complex. They need to have a decent amount of discussion here of what the requisite expertise is and who will be providing that expertise. Slide number 56, we're going to be discussing the budget piece of the description and feasibility. Now, there are going to be a number of budget tables we're going to show here just so that you can see them, and I'll call out a couple of things on each. Make sure you use the sample template, the table format that is provided in the proposal guidelines for your budget. Make sure that you have sufficient narrative description for each budget line item under. You're going to want to give quantitative outputs that are going to be associated with this. So if you have a column that says Phase 1 assessments and you have $50,000 in it, in your budget narrative, you're going to want to tell us how many assessments you're planning on doing with that money. The next budget there is to know your cost eligibility. There are some prohibitions on costs within the Brownfields program. We'll go over these in a second, but basically the main point here is never use the word administrative for any of your costs because those are prohibited costs under the Brownfield grants. The budget tables do have a discussion of what prohibited administrative costs are, so we'll cover those in a second. But we've got here in quotations, use the term program development or programmatic costs. Don't ever use the administrative costs in these applications. Equipment costs, if you're going to be buying any equipment or supplies, make sure that you discuss these in great detail. Again, under each budget table, there's a discussion of what equipment is based on what the federal government's definition of equipment is. Generally speaking, these grants do not purchase equipment, so make sure that you don't put things under the equipment line item when really you're buying some supplies under this grant. The definition is clear under each budget table. Slide number 57. This is the assessment budget. We're going to go through this for each of the three grant types. Make sure you look at the footnotes at the bottom of the budget table. This is where you're going to see discussion of equipment and what that means for the federal government. You're going to also see some citation here of what the procurement requirements are, competitive procurement requirements are for using the federal funds. And then also you're going to see it called out that brownfields-related conferences are generally acceptable costs under these grants, just so that people know that in order to complete these types of projects, we recognize that you need to get the requisite training and you need to be networking, and therefore conference costs that are related to brownfields are generally allowable costs under the grant. Slide number 58, this is a cleanup grant budget. The primary difference here is that you have the cost share row there at the very bottom under the subtotal. So you're going to do your whole budget up top for each task, and then you're going to have your cost share of 20% or more there along the bottom that breaks out by task as well. Slide number 59. For revolving loan fund application, you're going to need to have two budgets, and that's going to be it's going to be this slide and slide 60 as well. The first slide is for loans. And you're going to need to break out your costs, just like the cleanup application, by task for any loans that you're going to be making for your loan program. The second table that you're going to need to include is slide number 60, and this is the subgrant table. To the extent that you're going to you're going to be awarding subgrants to do cleanup activity under this grant, and that's allowable. Up to 40% of a revolving loan fund can be used to make subgrants to governments to do cleanup projects. You need to have a second budget here that describes how those subgrant dollars will be applied, what tasks they'll be applied to, and what budget line items they'll be applied to, as well as the cost share at the bottom. Moving on to slide 61. The next thing you're going to do after you discuss the budget is discuss leveraging. And this is if you determine that you're going to need additional money beyond what the grant will fund, this is where you're going to describe your ability to leverage other sources, both public and private. This is where you're going to talk about funds that you've got committed and that you'll also be seeking to complete any additional work that you've got. This is where you'll describe any gaps in overall project funding for whichever phase of your project you're in. And what you're going to do is describe what your project gap funding will look like. This could be we're going to use our general revenue for it. This could be we're going to apply for foundation money. This could be we're going to apply for other federal funds or we've received other federal funds. There's a number of different ways that you can describe leveraged funds or funds that you'll seek to leverage to try and complement this project. You're also going to want to describe or provide some examples of past leveraging funds that you've been able to leverage in the past for similar types of projects. It doesn't have to be environmental cleanup work, but other construction projects, if we're talking about a cleanup application, for example. So you're basically here, we want to see that you've got the ability to leverage funds. Slide number 62. This is where we're going to talk about programmatic capability. You need to show that you have the ability to manage this grant and oversee the work that is being proposed, that you've got the sufficient resources to complete the project and are capable of completing the project. For those who have previously received brownfields grants, you're going to need to talk to us about your funding expenditures, compliance, and accomplishments here, as well as any adverse audit findings that your organization has had and any corrective actions that you've had. Slide number 63, this is for those who have not ever received an EPA brownfields grant. So this is an either or. Either you've received a Brownfields grant and you answer the questions for a previous Brownfields grantee, or you've never received an EPA Brownfields grant, and then you answer the questions on slide 63. This is where you discuss your plan for managing and for managing this project and for performing the work at hand. Your in-house expertise with this type of work or your plan for acquiring expertise, and then your prior 3 years grant management, federal, state, foundation, whatever kind of grant management or grants that you've received in the past 3 years, discuss your experience with grant management with those. And again, any adverse audit findings that you've had and any corrective actions you've taken based on those audit findings. If you're an organization that has not received any grants, federal, state, or foundation in the past 3 years, you need to indicate that here. That will result in a neutral score of 10 points out of 20 for your application. If you don't respond with anything here, you get 0 points. So worst case scenario is to not respond to the programmatic capabilities question. You get 0 points. The next worst response is we don't have any grant management experience over the last 3 years. Then you get 10 points. And then anything else, if you have received a grant or you've received an EPA grant, answer the applicable questions. Slide number 64. So you've described your project and the likelihood of success. The next piece is how are you going to engage the community and make sure that you have the right partners on board in order to be successful. You'll be evaluated on your plan for engaging the targeted community with regard to this project, and then the extent to which you've identified and established relationships with partners that are necessary to be successful. And then the third one here, I'll just call out a little bit louder here, that you're going to want to talk about, or you're going to want to show that you've got letters of support from key partners. Those are going to be critical, and we'll talk about those in a second again. But you want to make sure that those are tied to this project, and they show commitment, financial resources, et cetera, to the success of the project. Slide number 65, community engagement. Describe your plan for involving the community in site selection processes, if we're talking about a community-wide grant or a revolving loan fund grant. Involving the community in cleanup planning throughout the process of selecting a remedy, for example. And then involving the community in decisions about what the reuse or the redevelopment will be. You're going to want to discuss past community involvement efforts, how you will communicate the progress of your project to the local community, what venues that will take, what, you know, if there are going to be newsletters, et cetera. Make sure you address any language barriers for the affected community here. If materials need to be translated into languages other than English, being the primary ones here, make sure you don't overlook that step. We want to ensure that all communities and all folks, regardless of their first language, are able to access information and know how that they can impact the project. And then create an aggressive and detailed plan for community involvement. Slide number 66. With regard to the partnership piece of this, describe your efforts and plans for developing partnerships with environment and health agencies. This is state and county, generally. You're going to want to discuss what your plans for the partnership are, how they've been engaged in this project, how you've worked in the past with environmental and health agencies on previous projects. You need to show knowledge of the state program. If you're going to go into a voluntary cleanup program, for example, you need to show that you understand what the requirements are of it, and if there are upfront costs, et cetera, that you understand that. And then finally there, indicate whether you plan to enroll in the state program at this point as well. It's asked in the threshold section, and it's asked here as well. Slide number 67. This is community-based organizations.
provide a description of and the role of community-based organizations involved in your project. This is where, if you're going to list a community-based organization, and again, community-based organizations are not the mayor's office, the governor's office, congressional office. Community-based organizations can be civic organizations, faith-based organizations, etc. And if they are going to be involved in your project, you need to describe here what their role will be, and then you need to include a letter that basically affirms that role from that organization as an attachment to your application. So don't list 30 different organizations, Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and etc., unless they actually have a role and you're going to get a letter from them. There is a frequently asked question on that's attached to the guidelines that discusses community-based organizations, what they are, and what types of roles they play with these projects. I would encourage you to take a look at that question and answer and see how you can work with these types of organizations in your project. Slide number 68. Now we're finally to the final piece, the project benefits is the final section. What are the outcomes going to be of your project? Under this one, you're going to be talking about the anticipated outcomes, promoting general welfare through the improvement of public health, safety, economic and environmental improvements for the targeted community. You're going to be talking about how this is going to contribute to the overall community vision for this area or for this project. To the extent that you can tie into perhaps a planning document, a 20-year plan for the area, or a carbon reduction plan for the area, or climate change plan for that area, that's going to be beneficial, how you can draw some correlation there, some tie into that. Slide number 69. Describe the environmental, social, and public health anticipated benefits from the redevelopment of the site that's assessed or cleaned up under this grant. These are both direct and indirect welfare and public health benefits that are going to be derived. We've got some for examples there: exposure, risk, blight reduction. What are your plans for the community and sensitive population protection from the project's contaminations? Have you put up signs? Do you anticipate fencing off? Will you do dust control if you're going to be disturbing soils or asbestos during your cleanup activities? Things of that nature. Slide number 70 are the economic and green space benefits, recognizing that there's not always a redevelopment component, that sometimes there's reuse that is not economic in nature. There's green space as well, benefits that are captured here. This is where you're going to explain how the grant is going to produce economic and non-economic benefits. For example, there will be X percentage increase in tax revenues by redeveloping a site, or there will be X number of jobs created during the cleanup phase or when the redevelopment is complete, increases in property value and therefore assessed property taxes for the area, things of that nature, what those benefits are going to be. And then the second one here is describe what the non-economic benefits are going to be for the area. Is it going to have some kind of a charitable reuse? Is there going to be a park there? Number of acres of green space created, et cetera. So this is where you're really going to get into what the vision is for the future of this and then what those benefits are going to be for the local community. Slide number 71. This is where you're going to describe the environmental benefits of the project, things like the reuse of the infrastructure on site or the sustainable reuse, the green cleanup components of the project. For example, you're going to talk about reuse of infrastructure, perhaps water lines, sewer lines, electrical, roads, things of that nature. You're going to want to discuss how your
This grant will help facilitate sustainable reuse for the future. If there's going to be green building requirements, for example, LEED certification requirements for redevelopment, things of that nature. If there's going to be stormwater management put in place for the area that will have improvements for surface water, things like that. And then also, if you are going to be doing cleanup, to the extent that it's possible, discuss what the green cleanup components will be. This can be things like reducing the emissions from diesel vehicles, for example, diesel reduction plans, things like that. So with that, that brings me to the end of my slides. Ted's now going to go over some helpful hints as far as applying, and then we will open it up for questions.
All right. Thanks, Dan. As you mentioned, I'm going to go over a few useful application prep tips here. But before I get started, just want to remind everybody to, if you have any questions, you can submit them electronically with the question mark icon. It's the second to the from the right icon there above the slide. And or if you'd rather just ask your question via the phone, we'll have time to do that as well. So pictures here are from Creed, Colorado, from a cleanup grant addressing some mine-scarred land and some tailings, and they're now putting in a cleaning up as we speak, and they're putting in a new Mineral County Fairground. So, on slide 73, there are a few basic proposal prep tips here, many of which we've gone over, so might be a bit of a review here, but definitely still important. And first and foremost, read the entire new guidelines and follow the instructions. Second, you can always get mentoring from prior grantees. We have those listed on the website there, and I'm sure they would be more than willing to help talk to you about your proposal and your project. Third, write as though the reader knows nothing about your community. Even though here in Region 8, Dan and I and others probably know and understand a lot about your community, we unfortunately do not read the proposals from Region 8. They get distributed nationally, and so it could be that somebody from Atlanta is reading your proposal for somebody from Boston, and they might not know the details of your project. So be sure to write it as though they know nothing about it, because chances are they might. And then bullet number four, address all criteria, and if it doesn't apply, say so and why. So, for example, in the community need section where we talk about reviewing the type, location, size of your brownfields, well, then list all of those. Don't leave anything out. Otherwise, you could potentially have reduced points there. And then new this year, we have the proposal checklist. So when you're finished with your proposal and you want to make sure that you have everything, you can go through this checklist and say, yep, got the letter from the state. Yep, got my threshold. Yep, got this. So we think that'll be helpful, and that way you won't miss anything. And then lastly, avoid using acronyms and technical jargon from your organization. We probably won't know what a lot of that is, so please be as clear and plain English as possible. Okay, and on slide 74, a few more tips here. Obey the 18-page limit. This is pretty important, because anything over 18 pages will go to the recycle bin. We're pretty strict about this, so please make sure everything that you want to say is in the 18 pages. And we do have the margin and font recommendations there. No color, 12-point font, 1-inch margins. And then also limit the amount of attachments required to relevant documents. Excessive attachments can get fairly complex to go through, so definitely try to limit those. And then typically we say a picture is worth 1,000 words, but only if you can see that picture. And that is, try to avoid maps and photos as much as possible. Just because we tend to copy the proposals to for different reviewers to look at, and the pictures and the maps often become not legible after so much copying. So try to limit the or avoid maps and photos altogether. And then on page 75, as Dan mentioned, encourage you to talk to your state or tribe or EPA with eligibility questions early. Don't wait until the last minute, and otherwise we should have plenty of time to get help with your questions. And, of course, contact partners for assistance in preparing and or reviewing your proposal. EPA here, we are limited on, now since the proposals are out, we're really limited on what we can say with respect to the competitiveness of your proposal. But we encourage you to work with some of our partners on getting help in that area. And, of course, again, remember to talk to the state if you are applying for petroleum. They will need to make the determination that the site is eligible. And, of course, set up a public meeting to get meaningful public input. Definitely very important. So with that, move to slide 76 for just a quick few minutes here on additional resources, and we'll get into the questions. Slide 77. These are the folks in our EPA Region 8 Brownfields team. And you can call any one of us for help whenever. So all of our contact information is on the website, which there's a link there. I encourage you to talk to us and give us a question or ask a question. And then moving to slide 78, here are the state brownfield leads in Region 8. On slide 78, we have Colorado, Montana, and North Dakota contacts there. And then on slide 79, we have the state leads for South Dakota, Utah, and Wyoming. In addition, we have on slide 80, we have some web-based resources. Again, there's the link for the ARC proposal guidelines. And there also there is a very useful frequently asked questions document, which we found to be, looks like it's very comprehensive and hopefully will be helpful to you. And then we also have a fact sheet on all the changes to the ARC grant guidelines, if you're interested. And then also, if you are applying for an assessment coalition, we have a fact sheet, on the coalitions and information about that. So I encourage you to take a look at that information. On slide 81, the top bullet there is a link to our own Region 8 Brownfields website. We keep this current with some really good information. Encourage you to check it out every now and then. And then also right below that is a link to the SMART-E website with really has a lot of good technical information on a lot of different topics, so it might be worthwhile to check that out as well. Slide 82, we're going to now open it up for questions. I also want to, before we do that, I just want to make everybody aware there's an evaluation form on the CLUIN website here. We'd love to hear from you on how we did today, so be sure to fill that out. We do look at that, and we'll adjust our presentations, and hopefully we can improve in the future. Here in the room, in addition to Dan and myself, we have Karen Reed, who is Brownfield's project manager, and Dave Schachterly, our grants attorney. So hopefully among the four of us, we'll be able to answer your question. And you can, to ask a question normally, not online, you can just hit #6 to unmute your phone. So why don't we start out and see if any folks on the phone have some questions, and if not, we'll answer the ones that we have online. So if anybody wants to chime in now, please do so. Don't be shy.
Yes, this is Eric Decker calling from Wyoming. And can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you fine.
Hey, my main question is, after slide 60, I couldn't access any more slides. I was wondering if I could, if there's a way to access the presentation some other way. I know you could beforehand, but what about back?
You know, Eric, this is Dan in with EPA. It's a fairly large slideshow, so I'm not sure how it would go across emailing it. But if you want to contact me via email, I'd be happy to send it to you that way. The other option would be, I think it's probably just slow right now, so I think the slides should be available. It may just need to run through your system once. And then try and open them up. But if you want to try emailing me, my contact information is, well, it's on the CLUIN registration page, HEFFERNAN.BANIEL@EPA.gov, and I can try and email it to you, too. I'm sorry about that. Things seem to be kind of slow here as well with the slides popping up.
All right, thanks.
Yeah.
Dan?
Well, since nobody's jumping in, we'll answer one of the questions that got emailed in. And if you prefer to send it in that way, that's just fine. Or just jump in once we get done with this one and ask any questions you have or throw out any ideas that you've got. There's a question out of Kalispell, Montana. Is it possible to simultaneously request funding for assessment and cleanup activities? If so, how is this done? That's a great question. We wish that there were a way to do this. There's been a lot of discussion of creating some type of a grant that allows both types of activities. However, that has not been allowed yet. The assessment portion and the cleanup portion are two separate things. In order to apply for cleanup funds, you need to have both your phase one and a phase two which includes sampling. Assessments complete in order to apply for the cleanup. So, unfortunately, no, you would need to apply for them separately. Either be done with your assessment already and apply for cleanup, or you can apply for a cleanup grant, an assessment grant. And then if there is cleanup or if there's contamination there, you could later apply for cleanup funding to clean it up. You could apply both for an assessment grant and for a revolving loan fund grant at the same time. As you don't need to have any assessment work done in order to apply for a revolving loan fund grant. However, the more successful revolving loan fund grants are going to show they're going to be those that have borrowers ready to borrow and where they already are ready to do cleanup in advance of reuse or redevelopment. Let us know if we answer your question or don't.
Dan?
Yeah.
This is Linda Twitchell in Wolf Point, Montana.
Hi there, Linda.
How are you?
Good.
In doing this application, each area would qualify for up to $1 million. Should we base our application on the need, on the funds that we think each project will need for cleanup, rather than on the predetermined amount? This is for an RLS application.
Okay, so you're thinking you're going to apply for a revolving loan fund grant,
mm-hmm.
and you've got some specific cleanups targeted, right?
Right.
And so you're wondering if you should apply for presumably the maximum amount you can apply for or something less because of cleanup activities you already have in the works?
Right.
You already have planned? Since it's a revolving loan fund, The most successful revolving loan fund applicants are going to be able to show that they have cleanup projects that they're ready to do now and that they have a potential for future cleanup projects next year, the year after, 5 years maybe down the road. And so in order to be successful, you're probably going to want to be able to show that you don't only have one or two loans that would be made, which would be kind of the option of we have two cleanups that are going to cost X amount each, and therefore we want a revolving loan fund for that exact amount. You're going to want to show we have these two cleanups that are likely in the works, and then here's our potential other ones out there, and therefore this is the amount we want to apply for. You're going to have to determine how much is that's going to be, but I don't think there's any advantage to selecting, saying we've got two sites and we want this exact dollar figure for these two sites.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions out there? Here's a question about liability, which is always fun to discuss. This is out of a town in Wyoming, and they're looking into assessing an old town dump for hazardous substances, and this may include putting in some test wells. And they're wondering if the town is considered liable under the Superfund law and for grant purposes for that old town dump. These are always very specific, very site-specific to make a determination whether or not it's allowable or not. These are the types of things where if you have a town attorney, you'll want to work with them on this, or you'll want to contact EPA or the state directly to discuss it. Dumps get very complicated because there are different regulations that kick in at different points in time in history for the age of the dump. So I would encourage you to discuss contact both your state DEQ and then contact EPA, and then we're going to have to discuss the specifics of who owned and operated the dump, when that was, what you're proposing to do to make that kind of determination. So generally, these kind of determinations take quite a bit of information to be able to really decide if there's a liability exemption or not. You want to take this?
Sure. Hey, this is Ted, and we have a question here from Valrico, Florida. And the question is, for coalition proposals, is each coalition member required to work on five sites, or is the coalition as a whole required to work on five sites? And it would be the latter, that the coalition as a whole required to work on five sites. And basically, the $1 million that would be awarded, you would need to use that for five sites or more. So hopefully that answers your question. And that is the last one we have online. We would love to hear some more questions. We have some people in the room who can probably provide you an answer, so don't be shy. Right, well, you're not hearing very much here. Feel free to contact Dan or myself with questions. Again, our emails are hotlinked on the main presentation page. And we do have our online feedback form. If you haven't filled it out, please do so. But want to thank everybody for your time today, and we hope this was helpful for you, and that's it. Anything else, Dan?
Nothing else. Thanks a lot for your time. Please feel free to contact us with any questions, and do fill out that evaluation form on slide 83. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, everybody.